This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Rebecca Roberts in Washington. Neil Conan is away. The young man who hid explosives in his pants and tried to blow up a Northwest Airline flight on Christmas Day was an unlikely suicide bomber. He was well-educated. His family had money. They called him, quote, a perfect child. James von Brunn, on the other hand, the 88-year-old white supremacist who opened fire in the U.S. Holocaust Museum, seemed to fit the profile. He was active in hate groups, monitored by watchdogs and law enforcement, and spent time in prison for trying to kidnap government officials. Two very different people, both attempting violent acts of extremism. So what do we know about who becomes a violent extremist and why? We'll talk with three people who've worked face-to-face with members of violent groups. And if you have questions or experience with this, give us a call, 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. A bit later in the show, millions of dollars are pouring in for relief efforts in Haiti, many through text messaging. What actually happens when you text message $10 to a charity? But first, what we know and don't know about what drives people to violent acts of extremism. John Horgan is with us. He's director of the International Center for the Study of Terrorism and an associate professor of psychology at Penn State. He's in studio on campus at member station WPSU. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Rebecca.
Also, Randy Blazek. He's associate professor of sociology at Portland State University and director of the Hate Crimes Research Network. He's with us from a studio in Portland. Randy Blazek, welcome to the show.
Hi, Rebecca.
John Horgan, let me start with you. Are there any sort of general checklists about how to tell who will become a terrorist?
Rebecca, I think there probably are, but the reality is it's very, very difficult. The answer is not something we're ever going to get from profiling, which is something we've relied on very, very heavily in the past. Profiles haven't worked for us because they've tended to be based on observations from very, very small numbers of cases. What we can do is adopt a slightly different way of thinking about the problem by not so much looking for personality traits per se, but for looking for patterns in the development of extreme behavior. Some of the kinds of things we've been doing at Penn State and the interviews we've been doing with former terrorists have tried to gain some insight into the decisions they've made about becoming involved, remaining involved, and in some cases even leaving those groups behind. Right now we're working very hard on developing a risk assessment tool to help us distinguish those extremists from those who actually go that step further to become involved in terrorism.
Well, how do you know, how much do you know about that? I mean, especially if you're interviewing people who hold or held extreme views but have not necessarily moved that step beyond to violence. Who is likely to take that step?
There are several risk factors that really distinguish the radical from the violent radical. I mean, the reality, of course, is that there are a lot more people out there that are radicalized than will ever become involved in terrorism. Those that do go the extra step tend to be dissatisfied with their current activity. They will talk to us and tell us things like they felt the need to get out there and do something rather than simply sit around and talk about it all day. For some people, they're happy to let off steam by fantasizing about doing something bad or bragging about things on the internet. The terrorist wants to do something extra, wants to take that additional step. A crucial difference between the radical and the terrorist is that the terrorist not only has to have the opportunity to get engaged with some group, but they have to believe that there is something very rewarding from them in the particular group they're seeking out. Now, that can be something like status. It can be camaraderie, excitement, adventure, identity. For some, it's even money. The same kind of logic applies to how we would understand the lone wolves. On the surface, they might not appear to belong to some kind of structured movement, but they do consider themselves as representative of that movement in a much more diffuse sort of sense. And that movement gives meaning and direction to what they actually do.
Randy Blazek, let me bring you in here because you've spent a number of years inside U.S. hate groups undercover. What have you found once you are inside a group? What are the dynamics within the group?
Well, I think this information is right on. It is almost impossible to create a singular profile because there is such a variety of stuff going on. But you get kind of two personalities that are attracted to these groups. One is what we might sort of label as the sociopaths or the psychopaths. Antisocial personality disorder would be the clinical term, that are essentially the same people that we see involved in animal cruelty. They are driven by impulses and they don't feel a sense of guilt. And in this world, they feel they can act out on these impulses and be rewarded for it. They also tend to be highly...
So the content of the cause isn't necessarily part of it. It's just the opportunity to act on these impulses.
Sure. And if they get the reinforcement from a certain peer group, that works even better. So we often see these sort of personality types in the leadership roles, highly intelligent, can manipulate people. And the other personality profile, though, is sort of the follower who wants a very simple black and white worldview of good and evil, of the forces of good and the evildoers that are out there. I mean, there was just a survey out in September that found that 10% of the American population thinks that the president is the Antichrist. And almost as many thought George W. Bush was the Antichrist. These are sort of the people that like a really cohesive worldview. And so those types of people are kind of brought into this realm where the forces of evil are easily identified, whether it's the great Satan of the United States or the Jewish-controlled government that white supremacists believe in. But the next step, though, is when they take that to acts of violence. And where we see that happening in the people that I've studied, and I think this works on the international level as well, is when there is a certain amount of frustration that talking about it and going on internet chat groups and chatting about it is not enough, that there has to be some escalation in this battle between good and evil.
And Randy Blazak, do you see the hate groups as being sophisticated enough to know who to recruit? I mean, do they know what you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's one of the things that I've studied, is that they are aware of who are the people who are targets for recruitment, and they'll target young people, especially the skinhead groups, who are upset about changes in their neighborhoods, who are upset about, gay pride or Black History Month or something like that. They really know the specific groups to target. But the larger recruitment that happens into the more dangerous anti-government groups on the right happens on the internet. I used to have to go to Klan rallies when I was doing my research. I had to sort of sneak into all these Klan rallies, but there's a 24-hour-a-day Klan rally happening on the internet, and it works on these hot-button issues about the black president, about Latino immigration. I mean, there are these issues that will pull these people in, and it sort of works like a funnel. You bring them in on these very broad issues about gun rights or about environmental legislation, and then it becomes a critique of the conspiracy theory view of the government, and then you get a little bit farther, and then it's a specific conspiracy. It's the Jews. And then the next step on the bottom of the funnel is sort of the Timothy McVeigh level, where you have to do something about it. You have to start the second American Revolution, and that those people will be told that they are heroes. So we can see sort of this parallel between the Islamic terrorist and the Christian identity terrorist, who both believe that they're going to be rewarded after their death for some grand act of violence.
Well, John Horgan, it's interesting that one of the things you have found talking to terrorist leaders is that recruiting wasn't a problem, that in many ways they had to screen people out.
Absolutely. I mean, terrorist leaders will tell us things that they certainly make a big deal of the fact that there's never a shortage of recruits for their movement. But one of the reasons why the groups will be so slow to take on as many followers as they would like is because there's almost a psychological prestige associated with the fact that there's limited membership. Some of the Palestinian movements in the past have made it almost an internal policy never ever to accept volunteers for suicide missions. There certainly are screening policies in place. Randy referred to those with psychopathic or antisocial personality disorders. I spoke with one former terrorist leader and asked him, do you ever have any psychopaths in your movement? And he said, well, there probably are some, but as a policy, we don't recruit them and we don't allow them into the movement. His reason for this is because the psychopath is the person who can't keep his mouth shut. This isn't the kind of reliable person that can be brought in to engage in a prestige operation. They talk a lot. They can't be relied upon to maintain the kind of secrecy that goes with the demands of life in a terrorist movement.
Well, secrecy and also boredom. I mean, it's not all glamour.
No, absolutely not. And in fact, this is one of the major catalysts behind why people want to disengage from the movements. Many former terrorists talk about the fact that the reality and the fantasy are very often two very, very different ends of a continuum. The reality is not the sort of the image of the 24-hour on the run terrorist who's just simply waiting in the doldrums for his or her next mission. The reality is, first of all, not being allowed to necessarily do what you want to do. Many recruits sign up with a movement because they have an idea about what it is they would like to do for the movement. And they almost always want the prestige position, whether it's to become a martyr, a sniper, or something else. They find very quickly upon joining that they don't get to decide what it is they get to do. The leadership allocates them a role. And that can be very disheartening. And it sets one of the very earliest seeds of psychological disillusionment for these young kids who are otherwise groomed into a lifestyle that really isn't as it's being sold.
Randy Blazak.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very true. It seems very romantic at the outset that you're going to be a soldier in this. White supremacists often refer to it as ROHOA, racial holy war, and you're going to save the white race. But once you're in it, there's a lot of being told what to do. You know, you're essentially taking out the trash for the older, more established members. There is just an incredible repetition of the same rhetoric. You know, it's Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. I mean, you hear these things over and over and over again. And then there are all these limitations about what you cannot do. So if I'm a white supremacist, I have to be careful of the food that I eat. I have to be careful of the music that I listen to, the television shows that I watch, because, hey, there might be a Jew involved in that show, or that it's not kosher to eat Mexican food. I don't know if kosher is the right word there, but and so there are all these limitations, and what at the beginning seemed like this heroic campaign becomes quite tedious, like cults, they have a lot of people coming in, but people are moving out the other side almost as fast.
That's Randy Blazak from Portland State University. We're also joined by John Horgan from the International Center for the Study of Terrorism at Penn State University. And we're talking about the roots of terrorism. Coming up, we'll talk with a woman who works with violent extremists. Stay with us and send us your calls, 800-989-8255. I'm Rebecca Roberts. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Rebecca Roberts in Washington. After a failed attempt to bring down an airliner on Christmas Day, we heard a lot about the young man who attempted the bombing and speculation about what drove him to terrorism. Today, we've been assessing who is most likely to become a violent extremist and how. A little later in the program, we'll talk about the organizations who claim to deprogram people who have become radicalized. And we'll talk to a woman who works with people who've become radical extremists. John Horgan is with us. He's director of the International Center for the Study of Terrorism. And we're also talking with Randy Blazak. He's director of the Hate Crimes Research Network. If you have questions or experience with this, give us a call at 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Let's take a call from Sheila in DePoyster, New York. Sheila, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi. My question has to do with, when is there a tipping point in society where extremism becomes kind of okay? I'm thinking of Germany or in Rwanda, where for a couple of years before the incident in Rwanda, there were ads out, you know, these are our enemies, and it was kind of a systematic thing. And that was my question. When does it become okay in society to say, it's just okay, we'll just pretend it's not there, but on the other hand, they work their way in?
Sheila, thank you for your call. This is the question about extremism, of course, is a relative judgment. John Horgan?
Absolutely. I think it's a very good question. I think one of the things we've really failed to do in recent years, and it's one of the great ironies since 9/11, is that we've really failed to distinguish extremism and radicalism from terrorism. I think there's been confusion about what it is we're actually trying to prevent. Are we trying to prevent people from having radical views, which to me is a sign of a very healthy, functioning democratic society? We're not really trying to prevent radicalization per se. We're trying to prevent a particular kind of radicalization from taking root. And I think Sheila's point really speaks to us being able to identify the kinds of conditions that say this is the warning sign that something might be about to take root.
Yeah, and I think John's right there. And one of the things to also be looking at is how the rhetoric seeps into the mainstream. One of the things that we've seen in the last 12 months is a lot of the rhetoric that we used to see associated with, for example, the white supremacist movement has been popping up in the Tea Party movement and has been flooding mainstream talk radio, and people like Glenn Beck and, you know, who have been sort of these conservative stalwarts are using some of the same rhetoric about illegal immigration and conspiracies about the government, and some of the signs that we've seen at some of these Tea Party rallies are the same things that you might see at a Klan rally. In fact, there's a group called the Council of Conservative Citizens that is a white supremacist group that has been organizing a lot of these seemingly mainstream events. So watching how that becomes more mainstream and sort of this call to, again, to do something, that this is our last chance, that America is being taken away by them, whoever they may be. It's, you know, usually the non-white male straight people, and to watch that rhetoric bleed into the mainstream. And I think we've seen an awful lot of that in the last few years.
And, you know, we've been talking about this in the context of the Christmas Day bomber and, of course, Islamic extremists, which get a lot of play. But we have to remember that for a long time, the worst attack on American soil was perpetuated by Timothy McVeigh, a white Christian U.S. citizen.
Absolutely. Right, and a veteran and white supremacist.
And was he known in sort of hate crime watch circles?
He had been involved with a militia group in Montana that was particularly anti-government and heavily armed. And so, I don't know the level of surveillance that the FBI had at that point, but he definitely was someone who had been on the radar because he was at Waco the year before at the standoff in Waco, Texas, handing out anti-government literature. And there are pictures of him there. So I think it was, you know, he was someone who the feds were keeping an eye on for sure.
Let's take a call from Gary in Rochester. Gary, welcome to Talk the Nation.
Thank you. I should first start off by saying I don't in any way feel sorry for a bomber or a person that, you know, blows himself up and takes people with him. But at the same time, I listen to some of these stories of some of these people that do this stuff, and I kind of in a way feel bad for them. Like this bomber at Christmas time, from what I read, had absolutely no friends, was close to nobody, didn't belong to any groups or anything. And I think some of these people just do this. They get involved in these things just so that they can say they belong to something, to feel like they're part of something. And, yeah. And I just wonder if that's true or not.
Yeah, Gary, I mean, not only just feel a part of something, but also give your life meaning with a sort of final blaze of glory in the case
exactly.
of a suicide stunt.
Yeah,
absolutely. I'm sorry. Go
we'll
ahead.
Take Randy, then John.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, that is so much a part of it. And the skinheads that I studied when I was doing my undercover research, they could easily have been a part of a left-wing group. They just wanted to feel like they were a part of making some change. And it was the white supremacists that got to them first that gave them their analysis of what was wrong with the world and what to do about it.
John Horgan.
The leadership of these groups are very, very adept at making young, vulnerable kids feel that they will achieve more in death than they will ever achieve in life. And certainly they're very susceptible to the kinds of vulnerabilities that you do see here. We're seeing the same kinds of vulnerabilities being teased out in the Somali community in Minneapolis, where you have young kids that are at risk of getting involved in something, whether it's gang violence or radicalization to a terrorist group, but they are at risk.
Well, but in some ways, the notion of a sort of rootless youth that needs some place to channel him or herself, it feels more preventable and more like a social problem that can be addressed, as opposed to someone who either snaps suddenly or has some issue that they're so burning with righteous anger that they are going to accomplish what they want to accomplish regardless.
Oh, you're right. But remember, it's only one risk factor here, Rebecca. There are other things that come into play. And this is where the group really relies on trying to give the prospective recruit a sense of what it would mean to be involved if they chose to express their anger and frustration in this particular route.
Randy Blazak?
Well, yeah, and I was going to say that we learned a big lesson in 1999 at the Columbine shootings, when it seemed like these kids came from perfect backgrounds, and that we miss some things that through the rearview mirror seem really obvious, including sociopathic personalities and stuff like that. And there's a lot of people on the planet, and so we can't control for every single variable.
Randy Blazak is Associate Professor of Sociology at Portland State University and author of the book Hate Crime Offenders. He joined us from a studio in Portland, Oregon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And John Horgan stays with us. He's Director of International Center for the Study of Terrorism at Penn State University. And I want to bring in Shabana Fayaz. She's Assistant Professor at the Defense and Strategic Studies Department at Qaid-e-Azam. I'm going to completely butcher this. I will let you introduce your university yourself. It's a university in Islamabad, Pakistan. She joins us here in Studio 3A. Welcome to Talk the Nation.
Thank you so much, Rebecca, for having me here.
And please correct me on the pronunciation of
your
university.
Well, you did quite a good job. I'm at Qaid-e-Azam University. That's the Qaid-e-Azam is the name of our leader who founded our country.
We have been talking about commonalities among people who might end up turning to violent extremism. You have worked closely with programs in Pakistan to prevent violent extremism. Do you see similarities?
Yes, I see a common theme here, and I feel, as has been listening to the discussion of John and earlier professor as well, the theme is a feeling of injustice. And injustice, and it can be of various kind, particularly from the region where I come from Pakistan. It's mainly the feeling of injustice is because of the lack of opportunity to excel, opportunity to govern yourself, opportunity to be a healthy part of a society. And on the top of it, given the earlier strategic landscape where the government in hand in the 1979 Afghan war jihad era, along with the international community involving the United States, themselves supported a number of militias and used religion as a fight, as a slogan to fight the infidels. And infidels at that time were the Soviet Unions. Unfortunately, what happened is that when the Soviets left and the U.S. and other Western communities lost their interest in the region, the same because of the lack of the government will and because of the lack of the resources, these factors continue to be on ground very much, and the vulnerabilities multiplied. So the as a part of the continuation of the civil war in Afghanistan and the tensions in the on the issue of Kashmir, these elements continue to prosper. So
let me just quickly ask you this: does actual injustice need to be in place, or can that notion of injustice be inflamed or excited by someone with the motive to turn someone radical?
Actually, in this case, you see a classic mix of the theory and the words, and the theory and the actions. Because if you look at the region that is there, bordering it has not been a main integrated part of the country, either of Pakistan or of Afghanistan. It is recognized in Pakistan's constitution as a federally administered area where you don't rule directly. The rule is indirect. And because of the government's lack of interest and the lack of resources, the area remained disenfranchised. Even they don't have a vote. The people who live there don't have a vote equivalent to the other people. So their representatives only sit in the upper house of the parliament, not in the lower house. So where will they get the justice? Now, what happened is that since the Maliks, those who were ruling, were also corrupt, the clergy factor that were supported for the strategic reasons, both by the Pakistan and by the West, they got filled that vacuum, and they became a de facto controller. And there they used for themselves later as an ideology. And you see the whole ideological, like you have been discussing earlier, that how the ideology gives you an identity. And in this case, it is more ideologically driven. Of course, indirect factors like poverty, lack of education, miscovenants, all add to it. So it is very complex situation there. It is not as simple as it is portrayed.
Let's take a call from Lachman in Nashville, Tennessee. Lachman, welcome to Talk the Nation.
Thank you, ma'am. With the beginning, I just want to say thank you, Rebecca, for all the great show that all the great subject that you bring every day. It's
thank
just
you.
Hard for us sometimes to get through the line. But today, it's one of normal days that you've got another great show again. It's a great subject. Me, as a Kurdish, I want to participate in this program because I feel that they should have United Nations, United States, all the international agencies, they should get together and have some kind of definition between those extremists who fighting under the terrorist title, and for those people who really fighting for what they believe, and they fighting on the ground because of their rights. For example, I'm going to give you a couple examples. The Kurdish, one of the largest Kurdish popular party in Turkey, being elected in the Turkish parliament, and 2 months ago they've been kicked out of the parliament. 22 members in the Turkish parliament under that, because they've been they have some allegation saying that this party being associated with the PKK, and PKK is one of the terrorist group on the list.
Yeah, Lachman, I want to give our guests a chance to respond. Thank you very much for calling in. Shabana Fayaz, could you foresee some sort of universal definition of what a terrorist is, or is it in the eye of the beholder, or depending on what side of the border you're on?
Oh, yes. Actually, if you look into the UN resolutions and others, there are more than 100 definitions. But the working definitions that has been adopted by the U.S. government and by the international partners is the one that is the terrorist is the one who attacks a non-violent non-combatants. So this is my working definition of the terrorism. And of course, you cannot identify terrorism with any religion. And I feel that one of the major casualty of the 9/11 incident has been the resistance movements, genuine resistance, self-determination movement, and this has been a casualty. And of course, the ones who were fighting for their justice have really been masked by the states as the terrorist movements. And this is a very, very critical happening, and the governments have to be aware of when they're devising a policy how to not let these people mix with the real, these ideological, global agenda-driven religious people.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's hear from Henry in Nashville. Henry, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hey, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
This is kind of going back to the first segment, but your guests were talking about, the ideal of joining a movement, it might not match up to the reality once you get there. And I was just wondering, how difficult is it for people to extract themselves from it if they decide to do so? And I'll take it off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Henry. Yeah, we have only just begun to talk about the idea of getting out of extremism. John Horgan?
Believe it or not, it is actually possible for people to get out of terrorist movements. Just as there is a flood of people who join, there's also a flood of people who leave. Some of the research we've been doing at Penn State over the last couple of years has been to interview people about the kinds of reasons behind their defection and the kind of process that pushes that. People are allowed to leave, but there is a process whereby the terrorist movement will keep tabs on them just to ensure that they're not working for some state security agency or the intelligence services.
Shabana.
But people do get out, and they are willing to talk about their experiences.
Shabana Fayaz,
commenting on the situation in Pakistan especially, we have seen the cases, some are the successful stories where other people are de-radicalized by the process of constructive dialogue and engagement at the community level. Especially one of my friends, she works with her own civil society organization where they work with the women as partners, as the vehicles to de-radicalize in the far-flung areas of the federally administrative tribal areas, where the real interpretation of the holy book is taught first to the families, and it is through the families that the message goes to the their men, their boys who have been radicalized and are part and parcel of that. This strategy has been has worked to quite a success, especially in the case of Sawat Valley operation in case of Pakistan. And this is one of the examples of successful story. But most of the time, there have not been successful disengagements because if you don't offer them an alternative, that's why we have been stressing to international community that you have to invest in the people through giving them technical education and empowering the different initiatives.
There is so much more we could be talking about on this topic. It sounds like we need to pick it up on it again. I'm sorry to all the emailers and callers we couldn't get to. Thanks so much to John Horgan and Sabaya Fayaz. I'm Rebecca Roberts. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.